You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday, the 8th of December, 2025, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that I have a guest with me today, quite an esteemed guest. He's the assistant editor of Heritage and Destiny magazine, and I don't know if all our listeners out there are aware of Heritage and Destiny, but it's an excellent nationalist magazine produced in Britain. It's been going for about 20 years, 25 years maybe. And the journalistic quality in it, the writing in it, is absolutely exceptional. And one of the reasons for that is because they have such an excellent assistant editor who we have with us today. His name is Peter Rushton. Peter, thank you for coming on. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well indeed, Sven, and thank you for inviting me and for that very generous introduction. I should also say, I suppose some people might be tempted to say, welcome back to civilization, but I'm not quite so sure when you came back from your unscheduled trip away, whether you thought you were back in civilization or not.
Well, sometimes it's hard to tell. Sometimes it's hard to tell. But one thing that has remained consistent was the quality of writing in Heritage and Destiny magazine. When I was in prison, they wouldn't let me actually have the copies of it. They wouldn't let me have the copies of it when I was in the hostel either. But once I was released from the hostel, I got all the back issues, which somebody had kindly purchased a subscription for me while I was actually in jail. And I just really, really enjoyed reading them and catching up on the things that were happening. And I wanted to get you on today because I wanted to highlight how it's different to what you would find online. I mean, what you would find online is a blog, and you may expect that if you were to purchase a written magazine nowadays, it would be similar to a blog, but it's not similar to a blog, and the articles that are in there you're not going to find online, and it's really in-depth investigative journalism. I know you've gone into the archives, the MI5 archives once they're opened up, and looking at what operations were carried out against old nationalists, that you've got a wealth of pictures. I don't know where the editor, Mark Kotchalk, actually gets the pictures from, because he seems to have amazing pictures from the 70s, 60s, 70s, old nationalist pictures. It's a really professional publication, and you can also now purchase it on PDF as well, which might make it a little bit cheaper for people who are overseas, but I highly recommend it. But I'm really not sure where to start. Maybe we should start with, when did Heritage and Destiny start, and when did you come on board, Peter?
Right, well, Sven, it started back in the 1990s, and one of the differences between the 1990s version and today, we've tried to maintain consistent quality in some respects, but there's one big difference, which is that in the 1990s, when it started, it started in the USA, because our editor Mark Cottrell was living in the USA at that time, and B, it was directly linked at that time to a political party, because what Mark had done, he'd been involved in nationalism. I mean, he's slightly older than me, and he also started younger than me in nationalist politics. So he started way back at the end of the 70s, when he was still a schoolboy in what was then the National Front. But by the late 1990s, he was in the BNP. He was in what was then John Tyndall's British National Party. And he started up a group called the American Friends of the BNP. And that was aiming at to do two things. One, to bring together the rather vociferous American racial nationalist scene, and secondly, to act as a sort of social and political meeting point for people of not just white people, but people of specifically British ancestry in the USA. And the American Friends of the BNP promoted the BNP specifically, as well as British and British and European the British and European racial nationalist struggle in the USA, where Mark was living. He was living just outside Washington, D.C., and working also part of the time for a legend of the racial nationalist scene, Professor Roger Pearson, who lived into his 90s and was involved in things like the Northern League, Mankind Quarterly, producing very high-quality academic material for our cause for over decades. And Mark was working in Roger Pearson's office, not very far from the White House in Washington, D.C., and living just outside D.C. He started up Heritage and Destiny in the late 90s, soon found himself being persecuted by the American authorities, by the FBI, under a thing called, believe it or not, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. This Foreign Agents Registration Act, strangely enough, they don't seem too concerned when it's people pushing Israeli lobby groups or people pushing all sorts of other alien lobby groups. But you speak up for the white people in the USA. You act in the USA, even sort of entirely above board, as a spokesman, as a promoter of British and European culture, as a representative of the BNP in the USA. And you suddenly find yourself, A, with a mountain of forms to fill in as a registered foreign agent, and B, even once you've done that, with an extraordinary amount of political harassment. So Mark had shocking political harassment over a period of a year or two, both from the usual suspects in the USA and actually, you know, from the FBI and the Immigration Service, the US Immigration Service, who in those days weren't too keen to build a wall on the Mexican border, but they were happy to build a metaphorical wall against white Europeans and especially white British people. And it all came to a head when Mark came over to Britain for his mother's funeral. On his return to America for his mother's funeral, he was told by the Americans, look, you're going to be thrown out of America now. And that's where, in a sense, where I came in, because he gets thrown out of America, comes back to the UK in 2002. At that point, all sorts of splits were going on inside what was by then Nick Griffin's BNP. Mark fell out with Nick Griffin pretty swiftly, just as I'd done earlier that year. And by the end of 2002, start of 2003, we sort of met up in Manchester, compared notes on what was going on politically, and I came on board with H&D as assistant editor at that point. And after a few months getting organised, I mean, you know what it's like with the break from technical work that's been enforced on you. Well, with all of the chaos of changing countries and working with different types of printers and different sizes of paper, etc., there was all sorts of chaos for Mark as well. So it took a while to get back going, but once he was back up and running, I was then working with him as assistant editor, and we took it from there. And we've been originally quarterly, now bi-monthly. Many issues now down the line. We're still going, thankfully. Just published, just checking now, just published issue 128. And in a world where hard copy magazines are getting few and far between on the nationalist scene, we aim to keep going for as long as possible, with the support, of course, of readers and subscribers. Because one of the things about a hard copy magazine, you actually need people to put their hand in their pocket and buy it. It's an expensive business producing an actual physical hard copy magazine. And so we need all the support we can get and all the readers and subscribers we can get. We aim to be flying the flag for a long time to come.
I say it is an excellent magazine. I didn't realise that it had started pretty much before the internet exploded. You're talking about the 90s. There was no social media then. I think maybe we had mobile phones. We certainly didn't have the internet on handheld devices. So
that's right.
It's quite amazing that it's still going, and it's now in colour as well, because it originally started out in black and white. So it had quite.
That's right. We're in colour. We've got more pages. So it's been onward and upwards, Sven, in those years. Yes, exactly right.
One of the things I like about it, you're just saying there about we need subscribers to purchase it. With the advertising that's in it as well, it's put on a separate sheet. So you can turn that, like when you normally buy a magazine at the newsagents and you read every page, every couple of pages, you've got adverts that you've got to go through. The same as if you're watching television, you've got commercials that you've got to go through. And with Heritage and Destiny, there's two separate pieces of paper with the adverts on it, which come in the magazine. And the rest of the magazine is all writing and exceptional quality writing and investigation. And a lot of the investigative work you do, and I mentioned at the beginning about you going into the archives in the library at London. And I know you have a blog looking at history as well. You write particularly on historical incidents, I guess historical revisionism. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how you came to be doing that and the sort of work you do?
Yeah, well, Sven, in a sense, there's two sides to that, which sometimes cross over. One side to that is related to the history of our own movement and the history of certain things that specifically affect our movement, such as the race laws, such as in changes in immigration, etc. And one aspect of my historical work and the historical work that appears in the magazine has involved the history, the changing nature of race laws in this country and the changing nature of prosecutions. Because when you go to the National Archives in London, after a certain number of years, just as you can access government papers on all sorts of topics, you can actually access papers from what's now called the Crown Prosecution Service and linked papers from the Home Office and what have you about prosecutions. So if we live long enough, Sven, we'll be able to access the files on the prosecution of Sven Longshanks and the discussions that undoubtedly would have gone on within the CPS over should we prosecute this guy? Are we certain we'll be able to get a conviction, etc.? And tracing the development of that in the archives and the changing parameters of what constituted something that was regarded as illegal and something that was regarded as warranting a prison sentence and an ever-lengthening prison sentence has been a fascinating experience. So one of the many historical topics I've addressed there has been the history of race laws. You mentioned also the security services, security and intelligence services. Ever since the 1990s, things that used to be completely secret, notably the internal files of MI5, have started to be partially, very partially, released at Kew at the National Archives as well. And that has changed, that has opened up an entirely new area of history. You know, you've always had economic history, you've had social history, you've had political history, you've had cultural history, etc. You've now got this specialist field, as you might say, of intelligence history. The history of history seen through the prism of the security and intelligence services. And that's been developing really just over the past 25 to 30 years, and especially within the past 5 to 10 years with the acceleration of document releases. And as you'd imagine, part of that again features the history of our own movement. So one of the things I've written about in H&D is a multi-part series about the MI5 files on Colin Jordan. The leading British National Socialist who founded a number of parties and groups latterly at the end of the 1960s, founded a British movement, which is still going. So reading those files on Colin Jordan was a fascinating experience, and I was happy to bring that to a wider audience of people who can't, you know, necessarily go down to Kew themselves and spend days and days reading through these multi-volume files. If you, with the experience that I've had of reading such things and analysing such things, I hope I've been able to make that sometimes very complicated history understandable to new generations of racial nationalists, so that we know how we got to where we're at today. The disastrous state of modern Britain didn't just happen overnight. It developed over decades. And the history of the intelligence and security services is part of that. Another aspect, of course, you mentioned revisionism. When you say revisionism, people think of Holocaust revisionism. And I approach that, again, from the angle of the British security and intelligence documents and the relationship of the British intelligence services, especially a thing called the Special Operations Executive, the dirty tricks wing of the British war effort, which had its own propaganda wing that became something called PWE. The relationship between sabotage and black propaganda services and what we now think of as the Holocaust story, Holocaust history. And linked to that again, the relationship between British policy and British diplomacy, as well as the British intelligence services, and the State of Israel, including the terrorist war that Zionists fought against the British Empire, killing British civilians and soldiers, as well as Palestinian Arab civilians, during that brutal terrorist war from 1945 to 48. In fact, starting that terrorist war, the Zionists were fighting us and killing Britons even before the Second World War had ended. And as they famously said, as is said in one MI5 document, when they'd been monitoring these Zionists and breaking their own codes, breaking Zionist codes, they said, these Zionist groups have said to themselves, when it's VE Day, when it's VE Day for Britain, it'll be D-Day for us. It'll be the start of our war. As soon as Britain's finished its war with Adolf Hitler, it'll be starting an open war with us, with the Zionists. And so it proved. They'd even begun it before the Second World War ended. But certainly once that war ended in 1945, there was 2 or 3 years of brutal terrorist war. So looking into the secrets of that war has been an extraordinary experience as well. And you'll see parts of that in Heritage and Destiny. You'll also see specifically historical material on the blog that I run, which is called realhistory.info. Between those two things, the magazine and the blog, that certainly keeps me busy.
Well, people might not actually be aware of what the Jewish side was in this terrorist operation against Britain, what they had against Britain. Britain was apparently not letting Jews go to Palestine. I believe that was at the root of it. Is that correct, Peter?
That's essentially right, yes. People like to throw mud at the British Empire, and sometimes justifiably. But it's simply not true to suggest, as some people might do, that Britain sort of handed over Palestine to the Jews with the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was simply part of the picture at the end of the First World War. And by 1939, for example, at the start of 1939, about 8 months before the Second World War began, there was a thing called the White Paper on Palestine, issued by the Colonial Office, by the British government. We'd been given, as many listeners will know, The British Empire had been given a mandate by the League of Nations after the First World War to run Palestine, that had previously been in the Ottoman Empire, that had been defeated in that First World War. So we were in charge of Palestine, if you like, and France was in charge of Lebanon, part of the carve-up of the Middle East. And the Zionists were putting pressure on those mandatory authorities to increase the number of Jews allowed into Palestine, and B, to build up towards what they aimed for, which was a Jewish homeland of some kind, whether under the influence of the British Empire or eventually independent. But in 1939, with that white paper, the British Empire started to resist that and started to say, look, we've got to draw a line here under Jewish immigration into Palestine. It's going to cause far too much trouble and civil conflict with the Arabs. If they're going to live together in Palestine under the British mandate, we have to restrict Jewish immigration. And that started a period of several years of intense conflict with the Zionists, with one wing of the Zionists using diplomatic pressure, especially from the Americans, on Britain to increase the number of those immigrants, and another wing of the Zionists taking up increasingly moving towards armed force against the British Empire, to defeat the white paper policy, to bring in immigrants illegally. What we now call the Mossad. What was the Mossad originally? It was in effect an illegal immigration network to bring illegal immigrants into Palestine. And then linked into that, after that, an illegal arms-running network to bring in arms to use against the British as well as against the Arabs. From 45 to 48, that then explodes into an absolutely horrendous terrorist war, most famously with the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, the British headquarters, the British military headquarters, and many, many other horrendous horrendous terrorist acts. They even, as I spoke about at a conference once in London, they even had developed a plan to introduce cholera into the water supply in London. This was towards the end of that terrorist conflict. And that was only dropped because they started to make, at the end of 1947, they started to make political progress at the United Nations that was just setting up. And they didn't want to distract from that political progress that they were making. So for as long as things were going their way from the end of 1947, they didn't want to go so far as putting cholera into the water supply in London. But they'd actually advanced that plan and even obtained the necessary wherewithal to do it. So that's how bad it was, and that's how much organized Zionism and the broader organized international Jewry that funded it was at war with the British.
That's just not known by most people, is it? I mean, where did you find the information about the plan to put cholera in the water supply?
That was actually, believe it or not, that was actually written about in the memoirs of one of the people involved. It's partly referred to in British security archives, and it was later referred to in the memoirs of a guy called Shmuel Katz, this is one of the reasons why people don't know about it. He brought out one set of his memoirs in Hebrew for a Jewish audience and one set in English. And I'm sure you can guess the story about putting cholera into the water supply wasn't in the English version for the English audience, but it was in the Hebrew version for his Jewish fan club to read.
And have you got articles about this in Heritage and Destiny? I notice sometimes you'll span quite a few issues, almost like a serial. And what you'll do is you'll be reviewing a book which has just come out by an established historian, and you'll look at it in depth and then add your own bits from your own research. And it might take sort of three or four issues. But unfortunately, as far as I'm aware, none of those serials that you've done have actually been collected into a separate book format. So if people wanted to read them, they would have to go back and buy the back issues of Heritage and Destiny to read this. Am I correct on that? You haven't got it on your blog?
Yeah. Yeah. Some things are touched on in the blog, but yes, you're absolutely correct that that part of one of the first ways that I wrote about that in H&D, for example, is when it must have been at the start of the as far back as the start of the 2010s, so well over 10 years ago, I did a review of the official history of MI5 that was brought out by Professor Christopher Andrew. And in the course of that review, that was one of the first ones in H&D where I wrote extensively about the Zionist terrorist issue, for example. I also worked with a number of other comrades in London, including our old friend Jess Turner, who went through the same experience that you've recently gone through of a period in jail under the race laws eventually. But Jess and I and Martin Webster and a few other people ran for a few years something called the Forgotten British Heroes Campaign in London that held conferences and rallies every year specifically on that issue. It came out of a campaign to have one particular Jewish terrorist who was still alive, Professor Robert Mizrahi, who was living in Paris. We wanted the British authorities to close the file, as you might say, on a number of terrorist crimes, including murders, by charging and prosecuting Professor Mizrahi in the same way that they're so keen to charge and prosecute people in their 80s, 90s, and even now I see over 100 years old in Germany for alleged crimes that they'd committed. It wasn't just an alleged crime Mizrahi had committed. In the MI5 files and the Home Office files, there's transcripts of his telephone calls and bugged communications and things showing that he carried out a terrorist crime on British soil in 1947, for which he was never prosecuted. And we said, look, this is an outrageous double standard. Why is it that such people seem to have a get out of jail free card? Why are these particular terrorists exempt from prosecution? And we were campaigning on that for quite some time. It's only relatively recently, a year or two ago, that Mizrahi died and lived into his 90s. This guy who plants a bomb in London that explodes in London, who's involved in conspiracies to plant other bombs that kill people, then gets back to Paris because one of the complications of the story at this time is that the post-war French government were keen in that particular period to develop close ties with these Zionists because of Anglo-French rivalry. Even though we'd been supposedly allies in the Second World War, we were rivals in the Middle East, and the French thought they could put one over on the British Empire by getting cozy with the Zionists in that period, just before the State of Israel started. And so as soon as Mizrahi got back to Paris, of course, he was in effect protected by the authorities there. And he ends up, believe it or not, this terrorist, professor of moral philosophy at the Sorbonne in Paris for decades. So not only a get out of jail free card, but, you know, a promotion into post-war life. So and a fair bit of my research on that issue was focused around that Forgotten British Heroes campaign to raise public attention of the crimes that were committed against our people, not just on the other side of the world, not just in Palestine against Arabs. It's not a Christian versus Muslim thing. Crimes committed by Zionist terrorists against British soldiers in Palestine and British civilians in London.
I remember that campaign. So that sort of ties it up for me as to why that campaign is no longer still going, because the subject of the campaign is no longer with us. So he can't be arrested for that. I do remember that. And I haven't been to the last two conferences, but I used to go to the HND conference every year. It was originally the John Tyndall Memorial Meeting. And I believe now it's a Heritage and Destiny conference. But the good thing about that was it was always advertised in the magazine. So you could, as a member of the public that didn't actually know any other nationalists, that was my way of meeting up with other nationalists, was to go to one of these H&D conferences. This is another good thing about the magazine. And I was able to hear you speaking there. That's how I first met you, Peter. At the moment in the magazine, you're looking at General Franco, and I believe it was bribes that Churchill was giving to men in Franco's government. Am I right in that? Do you want to speak a bit
about
that?
That's right. And that strangely enough, that's a subject that I've come back to after first looking into that back in 2014. And the reason I came back to that subject is that a left-wing liberal Spanish historian published a book called Sobornos, or Bribed, Corrupted, about that subject. And he started looking at the same files that I'd first looked at back in 2014. So I wanted to sort of, and that came out in translation. So I've reviewed that and looked back on that and looked back on some of the emerging documents about that, because it's another extraordinary hidden story that people tend to forget about. People know a lot about certain parts of the Spanish Civil War. People know a lot about the supposed heroism of all these Cambridge-educated poets going off to fight in Spain. People don't know about is that immediately after that period and during the Second World War, Spain, which was neutral in that war, even though a heroic group of Spanish phalangists actually went out to fight against communism on the Eastern Front as volunteers, but officially Spain was neutral. But there were all sorts of shenanigans going on inside Madrid, as in the other neutral powers. Part of that involved huge bribes paid via a gangster, via a smuggler, who, you'll be amazed to hear, Sven, turns out to be what the Spanish would call a crypto Jew, a converso, from Mallorca, from the island of Mallorca, part of a community of Jews who centuries ago had converted to Catholicism, but who'd maintained secretly their own covert Jewish faith and networks. And he was a guy called Juan Mar, spelled March, M-A-R-C-H, pronounced Juan Mar. Somebody who'd made his money out of smuggling in the early 20th century, and who by the 1930s was a financial backer of one wing of General Franco's movement. This is the way that the usual suspects like to back both sides, as you know. Because of those corrupt relationships that he had, there's no evidence that General Franco personally was bribed, but one of his brothers certainly was, and a circle of generals on what you might call the reactionary wing of the nationalist movement took money, in effect, British bribes paid via Juan Marc to ensure that Spain never came into the war on the German side, and to ensure, you know, that Gibraltar was protected, etc., etc. And that extraordinary story, which involved, you know, it even involved the British having at one stage to intervene with the Americans, because the Americans were seeing Juan Marc and his friends as, oh, these people are Spanish fascists. We must crack down on their illegal bank accounts and their business dealings. And on the quiet, MI6 and the British had to go over to the White House and the US Treasury at the top level in Roosevelt's government and say, no, you mustn't do that. You mustn't interfere with this guy. You might think he's a fascist, but he's our fascist, as you might say. He's one of our people. Now, what does that remind you of, Sven, when we look around the movement today, when we look around at people like Tommy Robbins? We see people who portray themselves as patriots, but actually have close relationships with a certain tribe. This kosher nationalism. Well, Juan Marc was kosher nationalism writ large and funded with large subventions of British gold. And I tell the story of that extraordinary corruption and those extraordinary criminal networks in a number of H&D articles, most recently in the review of that book that was recently translated from Spanish into English. My interest in it all, as I say, dates right back originally to over 10 years ago when I read the first releases of British documents about Juan Marc, and that those have been added to, of course. Well, the things about these document releases, truly every week there's something released, but certainly every couple of times a year there are substantial releases of documents related to the intelligence and security services.
How many years back do they go that they release them? Is it after 50 years, 75 years? How many years is
Well, in relation to normal documents, normal government documents, that's been gradually reduced. But of course, intelligence and security documents have a much longer date before they get released. So there's no statutory period. In fact, in terms of MI6, there's a statutory thing that says MI6 archives are never released. So you get MI5, what's now GCHQ, you know, what was Bletchley Park and all that, and you get SOE and the various branches from wartime SOE that was actually officially closed down after the war. All of those, you get their archives, but not on a – they're not forced to release things. You get things what they choose to release and fairly comprehensive things in some cases. MI6, officially you get nothing. You get sidelines on MI6 via Foreign Office documents, especially from something called the PUSD, the Permanent Undersecretary's Department, that was like the liaison between the Foreign Office and MI6. So you've started to get those in recent years. And so in effect, you get indirectly, you get some MI6 documents via that. But so it's a patchwork of things. So every year, for example, when you get big releases of MI5 documents, like in January this year, you might get 30, 40 substantial files released. And those will cover a wide range of subjects and a wide chronological range. Recently, the Cambridge spy ring, for example, this story, that infamous story, Burgess MacLean, Philby Blunt and Cairn Cross, the Cambridge Five. And we now start to get more and more official papers about them. And that's one of the latest things that I'm looking at on the blog on realhistory.info and very soon in H&D as well. Because for the first time, it's been officially admitted, or you've got to look very carefully to find it, that in the very early 1960s, the first KGB defector to reveal the existence of an actual ring of five, as he called it, Cambridge spies, Anatoly Golitsyn. At the same time as talking about the ring of five, he specifically said to his interrogators, after his British and American interrogators, that there was something Jewish at the heart of that ring of five. Now, what did he mean by that something Jewish? And that's a topic that I'm exploring in detail on realhistory.info right now. And we'll be looking at piece by piece over the next few weeks and the next 2 to 3 months in a series of articles, the most notorious subversive spy ring in history, the Cambridge spy ring, had, as this KGB guy himself put it, something Jewish at the heart of it. What was that something Jewish? How did the British authorities explore that Jewish element, that Jewish aspect to communist subversion? For the first time, we can actually take that out of the realms of vague conspiracy theory and into the realms of conspiracy fact. Documented fact, serious, high-level Whitehall investigations by MI5 and the FBI, and especially MI5's allies in the USA, the counterintelligence wing of the CIA, under James Angleton, James Jesus Angleton. So that's what the latest project that's on the boil.
So we can expect to see that serialized in Heritage and Destiny, can we?
Yes, we'll be seeing material about that in the next few issues of H&D, looking at that aspect of British history and how it relates. You see, these things aren't just gathering dust in the archives. These are things that shaped the history of the 20th century. These subversive networks, for example, are the reason why Stalin had the atom bomb. Stalin didn't have the atom bomb, and the Cold War didn't develop the way it did because of the genius of Stalin's own scientists. It came because he stole atomic secrets from Britain and the USA. He piggybacked, as you might say, on the Anglo-American nuclear project. And so within a very short time of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he shocked the West by having his own atom bomb. And so, you know, the espionage isn't just some James Bond fantasy entertainment. The conspiracies of the 20th century aren't just conspiracy theory. They are things that formed today's world. And that's why, you know, whether on that international level or on our own internal British level of the subversion of our own country, that's one of the reasons why I'm so keen to look at that. Because, again, we didn't just magically end up with a multiracial society. We didn't just magically end up with a society in which people like yourself are jailed. We didn't magically end up with a society where people like myself and our European correspondent, Isabel Peralta, are treated as terrorists when we try to cross international borders. We didn't magically end up in the rest of Europe with a situation where people in their 90s, like Ursula Haferbeck, are sent to prison. And on the other side of Europe, where people in their early 20s, like Isabel Peralta, are sent to prison, you know, for political crimes. These things happen for a reason. These things have historical roots. And so H&D, as well as reporting on day-to-day political developments, and we do that, by the way, from an entirely non-partisan basis, just like the meetings that you referred to earlier on are entirely cross-party. You know, at those conferences, we have people from a range of three or four different political groups, and some people who are no longer in any political group. So we're entirely non-partisan. But we also, in the magazine, as well as being non-partisan, we look at a range of topics that are not just day-to-day politics, but are the broader things that influence matters of concern to racial nationalists, historical matters, cultural matters, artistic matters, etc. And my work in the archives is part of that.
Very, very important work. And I do recommend people get a subscription to Heritage and Destiny so that they can read it for themselves and get up to speed on how the world came to be the way that it is today. Well, I'm so thankful for you coming on today, Peter. And we didn't even get a chance to talk about your many television interviews as well, which you've done. But we're really going to have to go now. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.